Welcome into this edition of Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lab. If you are enjoying this podcast on YouTube, yes, Rex appears to be in some sort of Canadian countryside with the RBC Canadian Open playing out behind him. Rex, we appreciate you taking this midweek podcast outdoors instead of in some grungy, dingy media centers we typically see you on the midweek show.
Let's flag this one and send it along to our friend Steve Sands, because we love having him on the show. Sands, he's one of the best. We love doing the Masters with him. That's one of the highlights of the year for you and I both. However, when we have him on the show, he always seems to be in some dark, dingy closet, and he doesn't understand why. It's a visual medium, man. So look behind me. It's beautiful. That's the big range that we have here at TPC Toronto.
It is beautiful. And if you are not enjoying this on YouTube, my first question would be, why not? Please like and subscribe, 350,000 strong over on YouTube. That is where we are pouring a lot of our time, energy, and resources. Also love getting into the comments. We can get to that at the end of the show. We have a strong field this week, Rex, at the RBC Canadian Open. We're going to get into that. Wyndham Clark, Sam Burns, Tommy Fleetwood, Brooks Koepka, and the like. First, wanted to button up what we were discussing on Monday with U.S. Open final qualifying. You cut us short because you had to do your little bobblehead nod, thanks to producer Sydney, at 9:30 a.m., despite our show not starting until noon. How did it go for you on your end? Again, you were in Canada, where, what was it, four or five spots available to get into next week's U.S. Open?
Six. We had the most available of all the qualifiers. We had the deepest field by far. I love taking it to Todd Lewis on that Monday morning, because he came on before me and made the point of saying that, oh, I'm at the PGA Tour side. And no, you are not, Todd Lewis. I was at the PGA Tour site. So it was no surprise that everyone that got in from my site were PGA Tour players. And I will say this, in young Sydney's defense, and super producer Sydney is doing a fantastic job, and she's probably going to do the same thing here in a moment, because I have another interview with Nick Taylor coming up. So this one's going to get cut short as well. She was simply following directions. There was a directory somewhere, and I know we're pulling back the curtain too much, and I apologize. There was a directory somewhere in Connecticut that had to get me nodding and doing the bobblehead thing at that particular moment. My day was long. I think everybody had a pretty long day. You had a rain delay, so I think you probably suffered through it a little bit more than me. I was just talking with Billy Horschel on my way over here. He qualified via the Ohio site. I was a little concerned because we had an 8-for-3 playoff here, and usually that number would scare you to death, thinking you're going to be here all night long. Somehow that playoff just went three holes, so I consider myself lucky.
Yeah, it was 20 hours door-to-door for me. I was traveling a couple hours to get to the site. I was at Hawks Ridge, about an hour north of Atlanta. We talked a little bit about the takeaways that we had from our respective sites on the Golf Today Roundtable, which just aired on Wednesday. I had a pretty eclectic list of qualifiers who got through. I had PGA Tour players like Chris Kirk and Keith Mitchell, who I think above all were just relieved that they knew they'd gotten in by nightfall on Monday night. As you mentioned, we had about a 70-minute weather delay. They were quite literally finishing in the dark. So not just being able to punch their tickets for Shinnecock, but knowing that they wouldn't have to delay their flights on Tuesday to get up where you are for the RBC Canadian Open, I think was first and foremost on their mind. You and I always have a running bet of who can make our qualifiers cry. I succeeded partially. I had a qualifier by the name of Jake Peacock, who was in his first year as a playing professional. He's from about a half hour away from the host site, so he had, I don't know, roughly two dozen friends and family who were there to see him qualify for his very first U.S. Open. He teared up a little bit thinking about the sacrifices that he'd had. Did you have any success stories on that front? I think when you look sort of large scale, we didn't have the usual suspects. No HVAC salesmen, no bankers, no used car salesmen. Like, we didn't have any of those folks who punched their ticket to our national championship, but we did have a lot of PGA Tour players, and as we saw in Florida, some pretty talented youngsters as well, including Miles Russell.
I'm a little disappointed you didn't pick up on this. Not only had success on that front, but I would have you seem to think you had the viral moment at your qualifier. I'll let you tell that story in a moment. But I would say from an emotional standpoint, I probably had the best, and that was Marcelo Rosa, who of course is from Colombia. He just earned his PGA Tour card last year at Q School. And we have to go about this in a very certain way, because you just don't want to try to get the player to cry. You have to sort of dial
in. No, that's cheap. Yeah,
that's cheap. You have to dial into that emotion. I did it in a very cheap way. I'm going to go ahead and own it. My producer, Mark Zahner, thank you, Mark Zahner, had sort of sent me the clip of when he qualified for the PGA Tour last year at Q School, and he did an interview with our very own Rich Lerner, and it was very emotional. And so I hearkened back to that interview and how much that meant to him. And what does this mean to you to qualify, not just for your first U.S. Open, but for your first major championship? And the waterworks came. It was very emotional. I walked away from that interview thinking I'm a fan of Rosa. He's kind of a special guy. He's a special player. He sort of literally dug it out of the dirt. We love those stories. And then somehow I got a surprise on the back end. My last interview of the day was Max McGreevy, PGA Tour player, someone who's been out for a while. And I gave him the very random, what does this mean to you to qualify for your first U.S. Open, with the last question. And got a lot of emotion out of that one. Little surprise. Oh,
I mean, come on, people.
Hey, man.
Have some intestinal fortitude. I did get Chris Kirk to at least offer like a half smirk. Smile. I got him to smirk, which feels something. Like a victory in and of itself. You also, Rex, had a little bit of controversy with Adam Svensson picking up his mark after Max McGreevy got through and was one of the qualifiers. Clearly, unbeknownst to him, he needed to finish out. Otherwise, he was going to have a playoff for the first alternate spot. At this point, he's now, what, relegated to second alternate for the U.S. Mm-hmm. Open?
I believe that's the case. I'm not 100% sure, because keep in mind, him raking his ball cost him a penalty. So yeah. He might have actually fallen to third or maybe even fourth, depending on how it plays out. And I don't think it's going to matter. To be fair, I was standing by the 16th green. That's where the playoff was. And he just raked it. He didn't even think about it. There was no malice. There was no ill intent. It was just an empty-headed moment. And anybody could have it in that moment where you're aggravated that you've been in this playoff, you had an opportunity. And I'm not going to make excuses for him, but I don't think he meant anything negative by it. I will say, and I saw some really misleading
headlines. I completely blame the rules official in that scenario.
He could have stepped
unless he totally blacked out on the first tee. It should have been made abundantly clear, hey, we're playing for the final qualifying spot. And keep in mind, you are going to need to play out the string for this. So we determine the qualifier spots as well.
No, absolutely. And I felt like there was actually a bit of a moment in there when the official could have walked up to him on the green and sort of stopped him mid-swipe and been like, hey, you might want to think that through. Because I'm sure he would have stopped and thought about it. Well, yeah, of course. Now, to be fair, there was some misleading headlines on Monday saying that he had a chance to get into the Open and ruined it, or, you know, whatever. He would have had to make that putt, which is about 10 feet down the hill. And I'd watched that playoff hole a couple of times. No one had made that putt. And then if he was able to do that, he still had to go into a playoff with Matt Wallace. And we didn't have a whole lot of daylight left. So I don't want to make excuses for him, but I'm not quite sure if you can sit here and say, yes, he cost himself a chance to be in the U.S. Open, because you're also banking on the idea that that site, one of the alternates, is going to get one of those final spots as an alternate going into
it. That's probably a pretty good bet. You're at the PGA Tour site.
I was at the PGA Tour side. As I said, he got six spots. It was by far the deepest field. The first alternate got in last year, and there's a very good chance. I spoke with someone from the USGA on Monday about this. They're holding seven spots in the field, depending on what happens here with top 60 in the world ranking and some other things that could transpire. But seven's a lot. So I can imagine there's a couple of alternates that are going to get in.
I didn't necessarily get waterworks, but I did get a pretty memorable moment from a youngster by the name of Chase Kyes. And if you're not familiar with that name, and you probably aren't if you're listening to this show, he is a rising sophomore at Tennessee. He was actually one of the top-ranked juniors in the country. Didn't do a whole lot in his first year in Knoxville. He made, Rex, about a 12-footer in near darkness to avoid what would have been at least a 3-for-1 playoff. Tons of emotion in that respect, in terms of fist pumps and, you know, high-fiving his caddy, hugging his caddy. It was great. My producer, Larry, my cameraman, Ramon, we were all high-fiving as well, because that meant we were not going to have to stick around till Tuesday because of the playoff. Again, this was in near darkness. So we were doing the interview, and, you know, he gave off a pretty confident front. And I asked him, you know, pretty simply, you know, what are you most looking forward to next week at the U.S. Open? And Chase Kyes did not realize that the U.S. Open was next week. Like, it was completely mind-blowing to me. And I thought that was really interesting, from the sense of, here's a guy who showed up in the qualifier and just was focused on playing well. I'm not even sure he necessarily allowed himself to dream that big, that he was going to get through. And that stands in stark contrast, certainly, to the players that we mentioned earlier with a Chris Kirk or a Keith Mitchell, who think it's probably their birthright to get through U.S. Open qualifiers as PGA Tour winners. And this is just going to be a simple. So I loved that dichotomy. And you could just sort of see the wheel spinning as he's like, wow, where am I going to stay? Who am I going to play with? Am I even ready to play in a major championship at this level? Is my game ready for that sort of stage? Like he signed his card and he put his hands on his head like, holy, you know what? Like what just happened? And now I've got a week to get ready for my first major championship. It was a very cool moment. Can't wait to see what Chase Kyes, as well as the other U.S. Open final qualifiers, do next week at Shinnecock. And again, yes, the U.S. Open is next week at Shinnecock. True. You're following along at home.
You took a shot at poor Kazmir Keith. He is actually on the range right now. So he had to go through a lot of traveling just to get here to Canada. Don't badmouth Kazmir Keith.
I'm not badmouthing him whatsoever. I was quite happy for him. I talked with him afterward. He was relieved to get through. He was certainly relieved. He said he had about three or four flights booked, and he was eager to see which one he was going to have to get on. He is there. I hope he does play well. He had a couple. He had a good finish a couple weeks ago at the CJ Cup. Byron Nelson. Again, before we get into what's happening in Canada, I did want to mention some note that came out from the PGA Tour on Tuesday, Rex, and that is that the Australian Open is going to be elevated in stature, boosted by the PGA Tour agreeing beginning in 2027 to help support that tournament in cooperation with the DP World Tour. You and I have talked a number of times on this podcast about the importance of the National Open and could this be a potential avenue for the PGA Tour to boost its stature, boost some of these tournaments' importance outside the United States. What did you make of the formalization of that agreement between the PGA Tour, the DP World Tour, and the Australian Open?
I think you can make a really good argument. Me being here at the Canadian Open, I would certainly make the argument the National Open should be, all of the National Open should be elevated. The Irish Open, the Scottish Open, we've seen have been elevated over the last couple of years. So you would certainly look at this as a step forward, the right step forward. However, I don't think that's what this is. I think this is the PGA Tour trying to put the last nail in LIV Golf's coffin. We all know that LIV Golf's success came initially, first and foremost, in Adelaide. They made the most of an Australian team. They made the most of a continent that has starved for top-level golf, and I think the PGA Tour clued into that. And it's a chance with LIV Golf clearly against the ropes. Their CEO did an interview yesterday with one of our colleagues at CNBC talking about the future of that circuit. But with LIV Golf against the ropes, I think this is one way that the PGA Tour could make sure that they stay up against those ropes.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. LIV Golf has made no bones that they want to own the National Opens. We've seen some of the success, as you mentioned, not just in Australia, but South Africa as well, with the successful staging. They're in Hong Kong, they're in Singapore for some of those tournaments as well. I certainly see that angle. To me, this was an easy win for the PGA Tour, elevating and emphasizing prestigious global tournaments without having to take on the operational costs of actually hosting and staging a PGA Tour event. I think from a DP World Tour perspective, they're going to have a real opportunity, Rex, to own the last 4 months of the calendar year and the fall, because you are going to have the core PGA Tour season that's going to run sometime roughly the NFL playoffs through about Labor Day. And then you're going to have an opportunity, obviously, outside of the cup, whether it's either going to be the Ryder Cup or is the case this year, in the President's Cup, to really boost some of these international, European, global events. So I thought this made a ton of sense from those two tours' perspective, as you mentioned, because LIV Golf was openly targeting them. But I also think it makes sense in the grand scheme of things with Augusta National and the RNA prioritizing the winners of these types of tournaments and signaling that they are important and granting invitations into the Masters and the Open Championship for the winner of the National Open. I guess my question to you, Rex, would be, do you see this as a future trend? Or is the PGA Tour going to target the Irish Open? Have the Irish Open, Scottish Open, which is also a co-sanctioned event on the PGA Tour, leading into the Open Championship? Could you see them making a run for the BMW PGA? Could you see the Spanish Open? Could you see the Dunhill Links? Could you see the South African Open? Could you eventually foresee a scenario where all of those tournaments are, if not under the purview of the PGA Tour, at least supported in a meaningful way financially and with some tournament infrastructure?
I think you can make a really good argument that they're already supported in a very significant way financially because of the agreement between the DP World Tour and the PGA Tour. There is a lot of money that flows from the PGA Tour to the DP World Tour. So I think you could already make that argument. I guess it depends on where we go in 2 weeks. You and I both will be at the Travelers Championship when Brian Rolapp hopes to be able to sit down with his policy board and come up with something closer to a final solution of what the tour schedule would look like in 2028 and going forward. If they come up with the track one and track two system that we spent a lot of time to a lot of listeners' chagrin talking about, we're not going to talk about that today.
Nope.
I can imagine a scenario where those events become track two events if the PGA Tour decides to make some of those track two events an international window. I could see how that works entirely. I don't see how any of those events work into the track one events because we're having this conversation right now. I am at the Canadian Open. I've spoken with a couple of Canadian players this week. If this doesn't become a track one event, and I would think it would based on what we know about what the tour is trying to do major markets wise, but if it doesn't, you're putting the Canadian players in a pretty much impossible position because your Corey Connors and your Mackenzie Hugheses and your Nick Taylors are going to be track one players. And I can't imagine on what universe, on what moon you can tell them that you cannot play your National Open. It's a track two event. It's one of those weird situations that I think the PGA Tour is going to want to avoid. And the conversation that you and I had, I think just 2 weeks ago, there's only so many spots available when it comes to whatever the tour track one event looks like starting in 2028. You wanted to put everybody lumped into it. You started naming off tournaments.
I named five or six tournaments that I thought made a ton of sense. Obviously Canada was one of them. Again, it would be a massive, massive financial implication for a company like RBC, which again, already is sponsoring and title sponsoring the RBC Heritage. That tournament is going nowhere. Harbortown is one of the most recognizable tournaments on the entire PGA Tour schedule.
Well, then it would be just such RBC to invest anywhere between $60 million and $60 million a year. And yeah. I doubt if they would want to do that as well. I think the numbers that we came up with was if you take the existing Signature Tour events right now, if you take the idea there's going to be two playoff events, the Players Championships, the majors, there's going to be room on that 2028 schedule for about 5 to 7 events, depending on where they land. I think you and I immediately ticked off. Torrey Pines is going to be one of them. San Diego, a major market. What they've done in Scottsdale, that's going to be one of them. So you're already down to 3 or 5, anywhere between 3 and 5 events. And you immediately wanted to start adding Colonial. You immediately wanted to start adding the Canadian Open. You immediately wanted to start adding, now all of a sudden we get into a situation. They can't all be track one events. You're going to have to pick one and be like, yep, you're on the outside looking in. Sorry, it's not going to happen. What happened this week with Detroit and news and the PGA Tour confirmed that Rocket is stepping away this year after a sponsor? I spoke with sources that there is a high degree of confidence that not only can they replace Rocket going forward, either in Detroit or elsewhere, but it seems as if they're going to have the option of being a tier one or tier two event. So you run out of spots really quickly.
It's hard to foresee any scenario that a National Open, again, isn't this the longest running tournament on the PGA Tour schedule? Like, it's hard to envision any scenario that a national championship is a tier two, track two.
What about the Scottish Open?
Isn't that already an elevated event?
It is not. It's a co-sanctioned event, which creates even more issues.
Yeah, but it's also a Rolex Series event on the DP World Tour. Maybe, I don't know, maybe it gets folded into that. Who knows? It's hard to imagine.
You're confused. Now I flustered you.
It's hard to imagine any scenario in which the Canadian Open is a track two event that's basically getting the leftovers from the PGA Tour membership as well as elevated players on the Korn Ferry Tour. I just don't see that scenario. But again, it really puts RBC in a bind financially with a huge financial commitment. You start running
out of spots, which I keep trying to explain to you. You want to write off the idea that Colonial, which I agree, should be a track one event. You want to say Canada should be a track two event. So now we're down to you have one to three spots available if we're going to go ahead and sign off on those two more. I just don't think you're looking at how limited this real estate is going to be.
No, I think I rattled them off and they all made a ton of sense to me. What's going to be interesting is some of these new markets that the PGA Tour is going to be targeting. Now we're down a rabbit hole that Golf Barbecue and Watches is really going to get
Golf Barbecue
upset with. But if you're looking at Seattle, if you're looking at Denver, if you're looking at Chicago, if you're looking at Philly, if you're looking at New York, if you're looking at Boston, all of these areas that the PGA Tour is said to be targeting because of the major media markets, it gets squeezed pretty quickly. Again, you're just going to have to prioritize the tournaments that are important to you. The ones that I've already rattled off, whether it's Torrey Pines, whether it's Phoenix, Houston, I think would make a lot of sense. Even if I think you could probably make an argument. I mean, you could certainly make an argument that Houston, based on the field they've had, is more in line with a track two tournament than track one. But they have leadership at that tournament that seems pretty determined for that for tier one status.
You could probably make a really good argument for almost every event on the PGA Tour schedule. That if it's not an opposite field, I would counter and say you could probably make a pretty good argument. But the fact of the matter is, there's only so many spots available.
Yeah, that's certainly fair to say. Again, just don't see for a scenario happening. Got a good field this week as well. You glossed over a little bit, Rex, what Scott O'Neill said to our friends over at CNBC, but it did make some headlines on Tuesday on social media. If you missed it, Scott O'Neill, the CEO of LIV Golf, could not guarantee when asked explicitly if LIV is going to stage the remaining four tournaments of his schedule, could not guarantee that those four tournaments, which are supposedly funded by the PIF, will go off without a hitch. But instead, he said, quote, "What I can guarantee is a heck of a return if you come invest in this business." So he did not. It was a complete non-answer. And then he turned it into a sales pitch and lobbying to some of the potential investors in LIV 2.0. What did you make of what the LIV CEO had to say?
I was sympathetic to Scott O'Neill because even though he did not have answers to all of the tough questions that our colleague at CNBC asked and did a very good job on that interview, he had no answers and he was putting himself in a really difficult, impossible position, some might say. However, he's also has to take this product to market and he has to do it quickly in the most efficient way possible because the soft deadline that they have set is right around October 1st. So however it is, he's going to sell this either in one big chunk to their version of whatever SSG is and private equity, or he talked about the idea of maybe we do this piecemeal, maybe we send it off in $25 to $50 million chunks, whatever the case may be, he has to do it quickly and he has to do it very publicly. And I think he's in the position now where there's a lot of doubt even among his own players. And we touched on this on the Golf Today roundtable, so I'll go ahead and circle back around real quickly. The idea that a player like John Rahm, who's under contract, or Bryson DeChambeau, who's at least under contract for the rest of the year, yeah, they're perfectly content to sit around to the end of the year and decide what happens then and decide what their future looks like. I've heard from multiple sources now that there are other players, younger players, who aren't under contract, who have started to look at the landscape and trying to figure out if this does come apart, like it seems like it's going to. And I'm not even discounting the idea that Scott O'Neill can pull something off, because I do think he can. I do think there's opportunity there that maybe someone would buy into. But if you're a young player right now and your main purpose, main goal right now is to get back to the PGA Tour, then you're probably thinking to yourself, I want to start that clock sooner rather than later. And by that, I mean essentially the suspension, if you want to call it that, would be a year since your last LIV Golf event. That's what Patrick Reed was told. That's what he's operating under. He's playing the DP World Tour, looking to finish top 10. He'll be able to play PGA Tour events this fall. If you're a young player on LIV Golf, you're probably thinking to yourself, why wouldn't I do that now? Finish up the season on the DP World Tour. Well, they would be welcome to back, try to earn my card back that way. And then at least midsummer or early summer next year, I would be able to start competing again on the PGA Tour. I think that's going to be a huge problem for Scott O'Neill on top of all the other problems that he already has.
Yeah, it's a point well taken. There is a 7-week gap now between LIV Golf events after the tournament in New Orleans ended up pulling the plug that supposedly postponed to later this fall. We don't know if that's actually going to happen. But Rex, we've been saying this for a month and a half, that if you're a forward-thinking player who's on LIV, if you are a Caleb Surratt, if you are a Tom McKibben, why wouldn't you have potentially jumped ship before the tournament in Mexico, which again was just a couple weeks after the Masters tournament? Then you're starting your clock potentially even earlier. I think the DP World Tour would be happy to bring some of these players into the fold, even if they don't have status on a sponsor exemption status, just based on sort of the caliber of their play. It certainly was a head scratcher, as I mentioned in the roundtable, that Scott O'Neill could, quote, guarantee a heck of a return in your investment if the Saudi PIF invested $5 billion, yes, with a B, $5 billion into the LIV Golf product and ended up pulling the plug because they did not see a short term path to profitability. And so for him to make that pitch after not being able to guarantee that the last four tournaments of the year were actually going to go off as scheduled was very, very curious to me. All right, you've had an opportunity to speak with like a dozen players on camera on Wednesday for the RBC Canadian Open. Run through a couple of them and sort of why they are intriguing to you, not just this week, but also with our third major of the year coming up next week. Again, next week is the U.S. Open, if you're paying attention, Chase guys.
That was funny. And I'm sure someone in his camp was paying attention. But in the heat of the moment, you got him at a very good moment. There's a couple things, and I don't want to get too much in the details. Tuesday here at the Canadian Open was not an easy reporting day, by and large, because of golf's longest day. Any of the players, the 40-something players who were in the qualifier here in Toronto, they did not make it over to the golf course. I can tell you, Keith Mitchell did not make it to the golf course on Tuesday after fighting his way through your qualifier in Georgia. On top of that, all of the RBC players, which there's quite a few RBC ambassadors in the field this week, they were off-site. There was not one but two off-site gatherings for those players. So there was no one here on property. However, I found one player and I actually loved this story. I really enjoyed, I can't say the same thing about our producer, but I enjoyed doing it because I can make an argument that Eric Cole is the hottest player on the PGA Tour at the moment. And I say that only because he's finished inside the top 10 in four of his last five starts. You look at what he's doing statistically. He's always been a solid ball striker. His putting has been sublime the last few weeks. And I know you're going to debate me on this one, but he lost a playoff.
I mean, you could certainly make the case. It wouldn't be a very strong one, but sure.
You can make a good case because I think we've had, if you take just take the last month,
and he's playing very, very good golf. I will absolutely agree with that. And I'm hoping for the best for Eric Cole, a player that you and I both like.
And he's trying to get that breakthrough. He's trying to win on the PGA Tour. So I kind of like the idea of what he brings to this particular golf course. He's a guy that hits a lot of fairways, and TPC Toronto is all about hitting fairways. So he intrigues me a little bit. And I had a chance to talk with Ryan Fox, the defending champion this week. And I always love talking with him because he's such a unique player. If you sit and watch him hit balls on the range, he has such a unique swing. But consider where he was at this point last year when he won the Canadian Open. He had won two of four starts in that stretch. You could make the argument then that he was the hottest player on the PGA Tour at the moment. I'm sure I probably did. But he comes back to a place, and I always love doing this. He won on the fourth playoff hole because he hit a 3-wood to 7 feet finally to beat Sam Burns. And he said then it was the greatest shot he ever hit. And I love circling back around a year later and asking, was there hyperbole involved with that at all, or was it still the greatest shot? And he could not agree more. Nope. Still the greatest shot I ever hit in my entire life, considering the situation. And there is also sort of a situation when it comes to Ryan Fox that he has been close a couple of times now of making that International President's Cup team. And he's one of those players that desperately wants to get on that team. But at this point in the season, you almost have to block that out.
Remember the RBC Canadian Open a year ago? I guarantee we spent at least 5 minutes on the recap podcast talking about Cameron Young and his inability to close out golf tournaments. Remember, he had an opportunity to win there.
Oh, yeah.
Blew it over the back, absolutely flushed his shot in the 72nd hole. Again, it was Ryan Fox who prevailed in a playoff over Sam Burns. The actual Rex, the actual hottest player in golf right now is Wyndham Clark. He's also headlining the field this week. he won at the Nelson, gave it a scare again last week at the Memorial. Tommy Fleetwood, I've seen a lot of folks fancying his chances again at Shinnecock next week for the U.S. Open, certainly on the strength of that Sunday 63 that he had back in 2018. Sam Burns, after coming close a year ago, played some good golf of late as well. Very curious, Rex, to see the play of three players in particular. Matt Fitzpatrick, who I think was an erstwhile hottest player in the game about 2 months ago, has not kept up that form over the past 2 months. Curious to see if he can rekindle that again. Ahead of a national championship that he won back in 2022. Curious to see Brooks Koepka, who's been one of the best ball strikers on the PGA Tour, whether he can find some answers with the putter ahead of what I guess would be his defense at Shinnecock. And Colin Morikawa, who despite suffering the back issue at the Players, had a couple of good finishes as well at the Masters, as well as Harbortown. Has had certainly a change in his life. With he and his wife, Kat, welcoming their first child just a couple of weeks ago, still dealing with a little bit of the back issue. And can he rediscover the form that he was playing arguably the best golf of his life earlier this year as well?
I think Colin Morikawa is an interesting case study here because we all know whatever it is that happened to his back at the Players' Championship. And we have watched how he has dealt with that in real time. And I talked to him today about the idea of how difficult is it to deal with the expectations? How aggravating is this? When you start your season the way you did, I mean, he started really well. He won at Pebble Beach. He looked like he was sort of reclaiming that form that made him a perennial top five player when he was winning major championships. And that's probably the hardest part now because he talks about he doesn't feel like there's anything specifically wrong with his back. It's not as though he's dealing with something that he's eyeing surgery in the offseason or something along that road. This is more about just trusting it And as he gets closer and closer to trusting it, he knows that the golf is still in there. Because I asked him, what would be your expectations this week or next week at the U.S. Open? And he goes, all I need is a little bit of trust. I don't need a lot. I don't need to stand on the range and stripe every single shot. I know the game is in there because of the way he started the season. But this seems like such a mental battle more so than what we normally see, which would be the physical battles for players at this time of the year.
Yeah, and it's going on 3 months now since Colin Morikawa suffered that injury. And again, still dealing with some of the trust issues, which I think were a byproduct of him getting injured on the golf course, making a golf swing as opposed
practice
to
swing
back, you know, picking up his kid or picking up a load of laundry, whatever the case is going to be. It was a golf injury, and that has spooked Colin Morikawa just a little bit. Plenty of good TV viewing, Rex, later on this week, not just on the golf front, but you got the World Cup starting, you got the NBA Finals going on, you got Georgia in the College World Series, which beginning on Saturday for their journey against powerhouse Texas. It's going to be a jam-packed rest of the week, and can't wait to dive into all of it and be a couch potato. You and I are going to be back on Sunday night for not a made-for-TV edition. That's right. Gary Williams is going to be picking up our slack again on Monday. He gets the pre-tournament, pre-major tournament two-hour window on Monday, so you and I will not be on Golf Channel. Instead, we'll just be on the Golf Channel YouTube page. Look forward to finding you guys there. We might fire it up live. We'll have to see how that's going, what your internet connection is going to be like at the RBC Canadian Open, whether producer Sydney is going to be interrupting you and forcing you to shut it down. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. We'll talk to you guys at the end of the week. Have a great rest of your week. We'll talk to you guys on Sunday night.
I had no idea what Kutsu Hill was.